Okay, everybody, welcome. Welcome. We'll continue. So Dr. Mark, we'll let you begin at 8:31 on, I know you always like to announce the date, Monday, May the 2nd, 2022, as we continue our series of the Rabbinic Response to the Rise of Reformed Judaism. Okay, Vavakasha.
Yes, and I wanted to make sure that Mel was with us because I see he's here. Because he pointed out something last week that I didn't know, or if I knew, I had forgotten, that I used the expression Netzach Chama, which, by the way, I have it here. Netzach Chama is used. I have a whole list here of Achronim and a couple of Rishonim also who use it. But he pointed out that it's not the correct, it's not grammatically correct. And people always say Nates, Davenant Nates. I was trying to, I accepted what he said, and I was trying to figure out, though, why wouldn't it be correct? Because Nates, meaning like the budding of Hachama, the Chama of the sun. So, from experience and having traveled with Mel and emailed with him, I know that if he says something, you can rely on it. You can take it to the bank. But I didn't know why I could take it to the bank yet. So after the class, I did a little searching. I Googled it, and now I have the answer. Well, first I looked at the Ben Yehuda's dictionary, and I looked under Nates, none. I have a PDF of the entire dictionary. It's like 16 volumes. So I didn't find anything under Nun. But lo and behold, I look under Hay, and it's on page 1134, and the word is Henetz, Henetz Achama. So what is this word? Well, I Googled it in Hebrew, and as is to be expected, I guess, Rabbi Mazuz's yeshiva, has a discussion on Rabbi Mazuz's yeshiva's website. Someone asked, should you say Netz Achama or Hanetz Achama? And the answer is given that if the hey of Hanetz is just the, like I was thinking, you wouldn't have it. But that's the truth is, that's not the case. And they point out it's part of the word. This is in Shir HaShirim, chapter 6, verse 11, you see it here. Hey, Netsu Harimonim. And the pomegranates were in flower, but that's the root. Well, the root is actually, or either that's the root, Hey Nun Sadi. That seems to be that's what Ben Yehuda has, but others say, no, the root is Nun Sadi Tzadi. But however you look at it, Mel is absolutely correct. And this form appears in the Gemara a number of times, where it says Hanetz Achama. So right in the beginning of Brachos, as I recall, and numerous other places. So indeed, we shouldn't say Hanetz Achama. We should say Hanetz Achama. Thank you very much for that, Mel.
Dr. Mark.
Yes.
According to that verse, the hay is a question hay.
That's a good question. It's a good question. I didn't want to focus on that because it complicates matters. But look at the previous word. It says hafarcha hagefen, which has the wine budded. Heinetzu harimonim. Now that would imply that the root is nun sadi tzadi. I guess this would he feel. But you, others have said that no, that it's the hay is dropped off, and there's no question that the Talmud and other early sources only say Hanetz Achama. The fact that they only say Hanetz Achama shows that the Hanetz you can't remove it. And I'm looking now in Ben Yehuda and. He thinks it's from the Hifil, Heinitz, not Nun Sadi Tzadi. But whatever it is, I'm not certainly not the expert in the grammar, but the experts have all agreed that it is, as Mel said, it should be Hanetz Achama, not Netz Achama. That is, it's only used in this form, let's say, with the hay in front of it, even if you're assuming that it's a Nun Sadi Tzadi. as opposed to hay nun sadi, in which the hay there is dropped off. And we have examples of the hay dropping off. Another thing I wanted to show you, because someone asked a question last class. Let me pull it up here. Someone asked me, maybe I was a little confusing about, I spoke about minyanim for women, where the men, you'd have a male chazan, let's say reciting in the vernacular. But I also mentioned times in the past, I've mentioned where women would lead the services. And that's correct. The two are totally separate. You had services where the men led it and services where the women led it. Now, let me show you something about the women. I know I'm going out on a limb here, or putting myself, making troubles for myself, because this then would, we're talking about women's tefillah groups, I guess, which women's tefillah groups were only controversial because of the social context. The fact is that every Beis Yaakov, as far as I know, has a women's tefillah group when they daven together. But I want to show you something that comes from this book. I don't know when we're going to return to Worms again, but when you go to Worms, you go to the cemetery, and here is a book, Hebrew and German, by Rabbi Levison, who was the preacher, the reverend. He was not an Orthodox rabbi, but Worms, the Ir Va'im Israel, became a non, before World War II, was already a non-Orthodox community, if you can believe it. At least the synagogue was non-Orthodox, but he was a scholar. And he recorded the graves that you could make out. And there's important graves there, a mayor of Rothenburg and many others. He records the text of the tombstones. And one of the tombstones he records that I don't remember. I was up by Worms by myself also. I can't remember if you still can read it. But you could read it when he recorded it in, I think it says 1833 or maybe 1853, 1855, I think. Here's the tombstone. It's for a woman. Her name is Urania. Interesting name. I don't know the origin. It's he mentions that it's under the, if you look in discussions of Gittin, Aliyah, and the Beis Shmuel, it shows different names. So he talks about that name. So this is her grave. She dies in 1275. It first mentions that she's the daughter of the Haver, Rav Avraham, who is Rosh HaMashorim, Tefillah Solotiferes. He's, the head singer, the Chazan. But then look at the next page. V'hi gam hi b'kol zimra l'nashi mashoreres b'piyutim. So on her tombstone, and this is going back 800 years, it tells us that she would sing for the women different PU teams. So clearly the women gathered together to recite prayers of some sort. And there are other examples we have of tombstones which say the same thing. That is praising the women for leading other women in services. And finally, I have to thank Yaakov for pointing this out. We spoke last class about the Nazir and what he did on Pesach. Yaakov called my attention to the Mishnah Berura by way of Rabbi Shimon Eider's Kitzur Hilchos Pesach. These works of Rabbi Shimon Eider. This is 1978. This was like this and his other works on Hanukkah, later did on Shabbos, were really the first halachic works in English from the yeshiva world. Which and created a genre that became very popular. You have some Hebrew notes, and I don't know if anyone uses them anymore. We have many more advanced type of works, but this was already when I was in elementary school. We were using these, and as I recall, even Chaim Soloveitchik in his article "Rupture and Reconstruction" and discussing the turn to texts, he speaks about Rabbi Shimon Eider's book as. As really one of the first ones to deal with halacha in English. And then, of course, it's going to formulate rules for things that were, as he says, mimetic. I never met Rabbi Shimon Eider, but I saw him because when I was a sophomore at Brandeis University, we put in maybe a junior, I was abroad, I think sophomore then. We put an Erev in at Brandeis University campus. And Rabbi Eider came up. He was the Rav HaMachshir of the Erev, and he davened Mincha with us. That's what I remember. I didn't speak to him. No, I was a freshman, I think, because Rabbi Lazarus, Yaakov Lazarus, was the rabbi. He's from Framingham, Massachusetts. That's my recollection. Well, if you look in the volume, later they published it all in one, but dealing with the Seder, what I'm going to tell you is explicit in the Mishnah Berurah, so I guess I should have known it. Again, maybe I knew it, but I forgot. But if you look on page 8, it says that if you can't drink wine or grape juice, and I guess if you're a Nazir, you also can't drink it. You can drink raisin wine, which you couldn't if you're a Nazir, or Chomer Medina. So you can drink Chomer Medina for the Dalakosos. So what is Chomer Medina? He says it includes alcoholic beverages, but that you can't, it's a problem on Pesach. Tea and coffee. So here you have, and you can find this in the Mishnah Berurah. If you look in the Mishnah Berurah 472, number 37, he says that you can take Chomer Medina. And what's the definition of Chomer Medina? Here he quotes from Moshe Feinstein that tea and coffee is okay. And there are those who hold Coca-Cola. Rabbi Teitz held that Coca-Cola is okay. Others hold it. And with the definition of Chomer Medina is often explained that if you would serve this to someone to come visit you, let's say, or even a dignitary, but just if someone comes to sit down with you, would you serve them as a drink? And yes, you would serve Coke to them. So I think most people would assume that it's good. Okay, so you want to start drinking that if you're a Nazir. Thank you, Yaakov. You can drink that. Okay. Let us pick up. We ended the last class. We saw Aaron Horan's retraction, that he takes back everything he did. We saw, he said you can't change anything in the Seder. That's a big thing. You can't change anything. That's what the Hamburg Basin says. You can't make any changes. And from that time to the present, you really can't alter the Seder, at least in the Ashkenazic world. It's become problematic. And whereas in earlier years, we do find examples of altering the Seder. And I want to show you an example before we continue with what I want to do today. I want to show you, hold on a second, let me move this out of the way. Even before I get to that altering the Seder, I want to show you something else, because I just mentioned Aaron Horan. So I probably should have investigated a little more about his descendants, because it was mentioned last class about the issue of the Holocaust, trying to get back stuff that was taken in the Holocaust. And this is Aaron Horan's family, Ferenc Horan. He's the grandson of Aaron Horan. Now, he converted to Christianity. And I'm not sure why he has a whole entry in the Evil Encyclopedia, because the Jewish descent ended with him. And the Horans that are alive today are not the Jewish. At first, I saw who they were married to. So I said, well, at least they remain Jewish until today. Then they intermarried. But already earlier on, we see that the grandson converted and obviously married Christian. But it was an important family. What I want to show you is something else as an example of how things can change. I want to show you the Gemara here that we say every time we have a wedding. Here it is. Okay, so we have a wedding. And we make a bracha. Here you see it on Ketubot 7b. Look what the Gemara says. Bracha Hashem al kenim acholam asher kishenu mitzvasa v'tzivano al ha'arayos v'asar lanu es azarusos v'hitir lanu es hanesuos al yechukba v'kiddushin. Now, most of you, if you're not a rabbi, you don't pay attention. You might see something's missing there that we say. And I will give it away now. Here I'm holding my... I had to do this one time in my life, so I bought it. I got it from the RCA, the Madrich, the RCA Life Cycle Madrich. So you go on to the wedding ceremony on page 90, and it says, let me read it to you, and you can follow along in there in the Gemara. It says, Asher kishanu mitzvasav v'tzivanu al harayos, v'asar lanu es harusos, v'hitir lanu es hanesuos lanu, al yidei chuba v'kiddushin. What does the Gemara say? The Gemara says, it's forbidden for us, the arusos, that is, if you only have a betrothal, it says, prohibits us women who are betrothed, and permitted to us those women who are married. That is, what this means is that once you do nisuin, then the woman is permitted to you. But I just read you. What it doesn't say that. We say, v'hiterlanu esanasuos lanu, that permitted us those that are married to us. Obviously, who else is it referring to? Look at the Ron in his commentary on the Rif, on the Beis Amud Beis in Masachas Ketubot. He tells us that this is the version of the Gemara, but Rabbeinu Tam Zal Higia, Rabbeinu Tam amended this, amended our blessing. And what did he have put in? The Hitirwano Esanasuos Lanu. You have an ambiguous bracha. You could read it as saying that through this blessing, married women are now permitted to us. Any married woman. Now you're going to say, well, that's crazy. Of course, it's not referring to now they're married women. It's referring to your wife. But the point is that the bracha itself is ambiguous, and the bracha creates a problem. If you just read it literally, why do you want to have a bracha that could be better, could get rid of the ambiguity? Because of this, Rabbeinu Tam added the word lanu after anasuos to clarify it. Maybe if you didn't have the word lanu, people could start making jokes, unsneistic jokes, whatever the case may be. Rabbeinu Tam felt it was okay for him in a case like this. And we have lots of examples of this throughout history before the rise of reform, where Gedolei Yisrael felt comfortable in making small changes when they thought it would be helpful for whatever reason. Now, because of the reform movement and the history that they've given us, we can't do this anymore. We can't alter our prayers. We can't make any changes. We can add on maybe new prayers, but we can't. The prayers that already exist, we can't start altering them for understandable reasons. We did a couple tshuvot of Rav Moshe Sofer, the Chasam Sofer. As I said, such an important, such a significant figure. And he thought very, Minhag Yisrael to him was paramount. He says in one of his responsa that if someone questions Minhagim, Sarich Bedika Acharav, that is, you have to question him. You have to wonder, what's he about? Because we know that if you want to subvert Judaism, you can subvert Judaism by being too stringent. We already derived that lesson from Chava. It says God says you can't eat from the tree, and she says, at least, it's not clear from the text whether she said it or whether Adam says it, and then she repeats it. It all depends if you want to blame the man or blame the woman, but plenty of them want to blame the woman, and they say she's the one that says to the Nachash, we can't touch it either, and that then gives the opening, because the Nachash can say, see, you can touch it, and it doesn't bring any problems, and the rabbis derive from there that call it Mosif Goreya. If you try to add on extra things, that you end up making it, creating all sorts of problems. Now, the fact is that often we do add. I mean, what are you going to say? You're going to say that all the rabbinic decrees, you could also say kol mosif goreya. But I guess it depends in the context and who is doing the mosifin as to whether it's we're not supposed to be adding on, I guess, because it could create problems. And therefore, if someone's questioning Minhagei Yisrael, Sarech Bedika Acharav, and as we saw last week already, the Chasam Sofer is defending lenient practices in the face of chumras, and he uses Chadash Asim in the Torah to do that. There is one other letter which I want to show you, because it really, it's an important issue that begins in the days of the Chasam Sofer. Actually, it begins before the Chasam Sofer, but he raises it, and it creates a big machlokas that I dare say continues to this day, and it also gets to the issue of truth-telling in halacha. That's always a big issue. If you look at my book, Changing the Immutable, the last chapter, a very long chapter there that deals with truth. Is truth a value? When can you depart from truth? The Gemara already speaks about when you can depart from truth. Can you say a bride, she's beautiful? If she's not, we hold like Beis Hillel. You can. And there's all sorts of reasons you can depart from truth-telling. So what about in halachic matters? Well, this comes to the fore in a famous dispute between Rav Moshe Sofer, the Chasam Sofer, and Rav Tzvi Hirsch Chayes. So Tzvi Hirsch Chayes, 1805 to 1855, a traditional Rav in Eastern Europe, in Zolkiev. But also a Moskew. If you look at his notes in the back of the Gemara, you can see that he is not like a traditional rabbi. He's interested in all these historical things. You look at his writings. His introduction to the Talmud, which I highly recommend, which was translated by Jacob Schachter, who was the rabbi in Belfast, Ireland, then moves to Eretz Yisrael. Jacob Schachter, who I knew, and he published a couple books, so he's a bit of a Hebraist, he's a traditional Talmud Chacham. He translated Rav Tzvi Hirsch Chayes' Introduction to the Talmud, it's worth seeing for everyone. It's his picture. He's the one that since I'm speaking about him, I might as well pull it up now, that everyone thought for so long was, well, not for so long, for the last couple of years, that he was Rav Yisrael Salanter. I'm going to show you the picture of him. So we don't have a picture of Yisrael Salanter. We don't know what Yisrael Salanter looks like, but I'm going to show you now the picture of this rabbi, Rav Chasheva, you know, Talmud Chacham, nice rabbi, but I wouldn't call him one of the Gedol Yisrael. For some reason, he becomes, this you didn't need Schneer Lyman to point this out, although he had a Sfarim blog post just 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago who pointed it out. But here it is. Here is the picture. Again, someone already going back to 2011 who was identified incorrectly. And then Farrell Wine, unfortunately, in his book includes it. This is not Yisrael Salanter. This is none other than Rabbi Jacob Schachter, the Rav of Belfast, Ireland, who wrote some interesting things. And also you can read, here he is. He wrote this book and he includes his picture in the book, the Hebrew book, title page, and also the English volume. It's a little embarrassing because Rabbi Wine, in his interview with Art Scroll, says that you can look at this picture and you could see Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, you could see the Musar personality, you could see the greatness of the man. Well, maybe you could see the greatness of the man, but it's not Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. It's totally someone totally different. But if you've convinced that shows me that if you've convinced yourself, as Rabbi Wine had, that this was Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, then it's he's seeing in Jacob Schachter, who again is a fine Jew, but he's not one of the Gedol Yisrael. He looks like Shomer Shabbos. He looks like a fine Jew. Very, yeah, indeed. So I highly recommend everyone to read Rav Tzvi Hirsch Chayes' Introduction to the Talmud. Now, the issue that they were having a dispute about is the same issue we began this course. Remember, delayed burial, which we spoke about, the dispute between Rebecca Emden and Mendelssohn, and how Yaakov Emden says you can't ever delay burial because of some far-fetched suffix that maybe the person's still alive. Although I saw in the Drudge Report today, it's probably still on there, that they were burying a woman in Peru, and you have a video of this, you have a video right afterwards, and she starts banging on the coffin. It just happened yesterday. You don't have the video of her banging on the coffin, but you have the video as soon as they open it up. And, so they thought she was dead. She was hit, I think, in that car or something. And they quickly put her in a coffin and they're about to bury her and she's banging on the coffin. It's a true case. And like I said, I saw it this morning on the Drudge Report. And Mendelssohn thought that it was a good idea to, keep the body on ice for a few days. This didn't end with Mendelssohn and Rav Yaakov Emden. It continued to be an issue, and reform-minded Jews continued with this practice that we don't bury immediately. We leave it out for a few days. And it was in response to this that the Chasam Sofer takes these reformist tendencies. The Chasam Sofer takes a very strong stand affirming what Yaakov Emden says. He quotes from Yaakov Emden, and that you need to, I think he, if I recall correctly, he even there, that's where one of the places where he refers to Mendelssohn as Chacham Moshe Midasa, I think so. I'm not 100% sure if there. He mentions him in his ethical will, which was referred to last class, but I think there as well. And he expressed this view that we have to bury immediately. We're not concerned, like the Rebbe Vinden said, with far-fetched tzveikot in a letter to Rav Tzvi Hirsch Chayes. We see that Rav Tzvi Hirsch Chayes was sympathetic to the Mendelssohnian position that now that modern medicine is telling us that people might not really be dead, he thought that there's no reason why not to delay burial. As someone with Haskala tendencies and someone very interested in modern science, if this is true, why not? Just like Mitzitza. Why is it that we don't do Mitzitza B'peh, at least in most of our communities? Because the medical science tells us that it could spread disease, and that's the only reason. And at least in the Litvish community, it wasn't an issue, and the German communities, because we have the facts that diseases could be spread. Rav Tzvi Hirsch Chayes is put in his place, I guess you could say, by the Chasam Sofer. In fact, if you look in the Tshuvas of the Chasam Sofer, it does not even reveal who the letter is written to. And that is no doubt because when the Tshuva was published posthumously, the children of the Chasam Sofer, knowing Rav Tzvi Hirsch Chayes, he's problematic in certain circles because of his Haskalah sympathies. They did not include the name of the recipient. But we know the name of the recipient because Tzvi Hirsch Chayes himself, in his collected writings, he includes it. And he includes other things we'll see right now as well. Now, in his letter to Rav Tzvi Hirsch Chayes, a couple more things about him. There's a very nice Hebrew biography of him by Meir Hershkovitz. The late Rabbi Dr. Meir Hershkovitz, published by Mossad Rav Kook. He has everything imaginable ever written by and about Rav Tzvi Hirsch Chayes. But if you, and it's full of fascinating sources, but if you really want insight into Rav Tzvi Hirsch Chayes, and if you really want to come away seeing him as more of a maskil than a traditional Talmudist, I have to recommend Bruya Huttner David's Columbia University doctoral dissertation. That's Rav Huttner, Rav Yitzhak Huttner's daughters. She went to Columbia. The women, of course, as we know, always were able to get advanced education. She didn't just get an advanced education. She got a PhD, and she wrote an unbelievably good doctoral dissertation on Rav Tzvi Hirsch Chayes. I asked Yaakov Elman, the late Rabbi Dr. Yaakov Elman once, because the dissertation is not very respectful. You don't come away with such good feelings about Rav Tzvi Hirsch Chayes. You see him as one of these people who was really caught between two worlds. And I asked Yaakov Elman, would her father have approved of this? And he told me yes. Apparently he knew that Rav Huttner was no fan of Rav Tzvi Hirsch Chayes. The Belzer Hasidim, I think it's the Belzers, they tear out Rav Tzvi Hirsch Chayes's commentary in the back, or at least that's what I've been told. But look, he's one of our Gedolei Yisrael. He could be he's a bit of a modern Orthodox type. He's not the only one. We have a number of them, and he's a very important figure. But I have Bruya Huttner David's dissertation. If anyone wants, I could send it to you. I think I have a PDF. Many of you have been writing me for PDFs. I believe I have a PDF of that as well. So in his letter, in the Chasam Sofer's letter to Maritz Chayes, he says that if you don't bury immediately, you violate two Torah commandments, a positive commandment to bury immediately and a negative one not to leave out. Rav Tzvi Hirsch Chayes replies to the Chasam Sofer and says that he's mistaken in this assumption. There's only one prohibition that you violate, namely the negative prohibition. To this, the Chasam Sofer replies again to Rav Tzvi Hirsch Chayes, and this is what I want to show you. You can see it in, this is in the collected writings of the volume Darche Arah, the collected writings of Rav Tzvi Hirsch Chayes, and this is the second letter that he received from the Chasam Sofer. And the Chasam Sofer begins by saying, I received your letter when Shabbos was starting, but so now I'm writing back to you. I'm writing, he says, I'm writing about, talk about what I said, Chodesh Hashem in the Torah. So we see already, again, he likes that expression. He's using it. He says, I didn't say Orla and Kilayim, but Chadash. Why? Because we have to go by the people who've established the Torah. We can't open up new things, because if you open up a little bit, a crack as fine as a needle, that's the expression they use, is Yifritzu Peretz Alpanei Peretz. That is, you give a little bit, everything's going to open up. And the reformers will take a little bit, and they'll run with it. So we have to chadash aspetura. We can't. What's the chadash here? The chadash here is getting rid of immediate burial. And then he says, look in the Hagos Maimonios, the Chuvos there in Hilchos Machos. He says, al davar kal lisa isha b'soch shlosh regolim shemesa ishto. There's a according to halacha. If, let's say, you haven't fulfilled Pru or Vu, you're allowed to remarry before a year, before the three holidays. Or if, let's say, you need a wife to take care of your children. But in Ashkenaz, the practice was let the three pilgrimage festivals go by. And he quotes the Golos Maimonides here that he calls it a davar kal. And nevertheless, they were stringent on this. Then the Chasam Sofer says, "Ani kasafte halonas mesim yeshbo asay." I said that leaving, not burying the body immediately, it's an asay, analos asay. Why? And the Maritz Chaya says that's not true. That's not what we assume. But he says why? Ki al kol panim haRamban kasaf kein, because at least the Ramban says it. So even though all the other Rishonim and the standard view is that it's only. There's only a lav, but since the Ramban says that there's both a positive and negative, therefore I felt comfortable in stating just as a fact that you violate two things. And then he says in nafkusaladina bismana zeladina. He says that there's no nafkamina. It doesn't matter halachically whether it's if I say there's a lav and a positive commandment. And almost everyone thinks there's only a lav. What's the difference? It doesn't matter. It's still a halacha. It's still a mitzvah in the Torah. What's it matter? And then he says, "V'tov lahalos ha'iser." The Chasam Sofer says, "I quoted from the Ramban, even though this isn't the standard position that you violate both a lav and an asay. Why? Because in our day and age, tov lahalos ha'iser." It's good to raise the level of the Isser. What does this mean? It's good to raise the level of the Isser. It's good to let the people, in an era when the reform is threatening us and people are looking for all sorts of new things, it's good to let them think that it's even more of an offense than it is. Now, we're going to come back in a minute to see what Ritzvi Yerushalayis has to say about this. But I want to just tell you, he continues in his letter. He says that Maritz Chayes, he criticized him for relying on a view of the Chavos Yair that we reject. He says, Bavonoseinu Harabim, in our generation, we can't say that something's derabanan. Why? Because the people today say, we don't care about the rabbis. You know, it's very dangerous, he tells Ritzvi Yerushalayis, to start telling the people that this is only a rabbinic prohibition. And then he says, the Noda B'Yehuda, the great Rebbe Cheskel Lando, nichshal bazeh. He erred in this matter. Why? Because he said that let's say you have a store and you have to keep your store open on Shabbos by a non-Jew running it. Let's say you sell it to the non-Jew or you do it in some halachically permissible way. Sometimes you'll have to write something down. Like let's say there's a delivery and we're talking about where there's a heter to have the store, but there's a delivery. So you have to write something. So he says the Noda B'Yehuda was somech on a Shas HaTachak and a Hefseid Meruba. Where it's a lot of loss of money, you could lose your whole livelihood, so you need to permit this. Kasivas goy b'chanus b'shabbos. That is, there is such an opinion, he calls it a dea d'chuya, a rejected opinion, that ksav galachos lomidaraisa. That's the ksav, the writing of the priest, that is a Latin, non-Hebraic writing. That's what they refer to, let's say, in the vernacular. That it's not midiraisa. So since it's not midiraisa, it's only midirabanan. So it's a shvus. It's a shasad chak. You can do that. And then listen what the Chasam Sofer says. It's right over here where it says Ulam. He says, Ulam, the Mechilas Kavodo, all due respect to the Noda Behuda, Hekar Ha'ambati, or Ambatia, he's made cool the pool. What's he referring to there? I'll show you what he's referring to. He's referring to, you know it from Rashi, but it's a Gemara. It's in Parshas Kisetze. It says, Asher Karcha Baderach. It's Amalek came upon you on the rear. So what is this word Karcha? So Rashi gives a few explanations, and one of his explanations is, he thinks the word Karcha, he says, it's from the word Kor. He cooled you off and made you appear tepid. That is, people were afraid of Bnei Yisrael. But once Amalek comes in and fights, then they come in. And what does Rashi say? Mosho Ambate, you know, it's like what does it say? A bathtub of boiling water. But once Amalek does it, then everyone feels they can jump in. And that's the exact same thing here. He says that... He says that once you tell them that it's only Darabonan, you're now lessening the sin. You're saying that writing is not a Daraisa, it's only Darabonan. Now you've lessened it, and everyone can jump in. And then he says, V'harashayim kosi b'shabas adashu Darabonan. These Rishayim, they say, well, it's only Darabonan. The note of Yehuda, he's lessened the stringency, so now they all jump in. They're not concerned with the Rabbanan of these people. Now listen, he's talking about people who apparently were not, if it's Daraisa, they'd be concerned. We're not at the stage now where what we're going to see soon, the next generation, where they don't care about Daraisa also. We're talking about, and I heard this growing up, you hear this in very liberal modern Orthodox section, when they ask about halacha, where is that halacha? Where does that come from? And you see the rabbis, and people will say, well, I don't, you know, if you told me it's a Torah, it's one thing. The rabbis, you know, you tell someone why they can't go swimming, let's say, in a pool. You know, you build a boat or things like that. Do they hear what the rabbis, so the ones he's calling Rishayim are like, you know, very liberal modern Orthodox who, if it's the rabbis, that I can be lenient. And there is such a phenomenon of people who are serious when it comes to the Torah, but the rabbis, they're not so serious about. And he says, it said, Chachamim Hisar B'Divrechem. It says in Avos, the sages, you need to be careful with your words because you could say something and it can lead to all sorts of bad results. He says, "Ubisman hazeh bevadai, rabim yishtu abay macharim." And many have already drunk. What is he referring to? He's referring to in Perkei Avos. It says as follows: Avtalion says, "Chachamim hisarub divrechem." You have to be careful. Take heed with your words. Shema tachuvu chovas golos, because lest you incur the punishment of exile. V'sigu umakom mayim rai. You'll be sent away to the place of evil waters. And the students that come after will drink of it and die. What this means is that you're going to, through what you say, the place of evil waters is heresy. You're going to end up in a place of heresy, or maybe it refers to Alexandria. There's all different opinions. But what he's saying is obvious that... I want to get back to the screen. You're going to be responsible as a Rav if you say something, if you give a heter without understanding the implications, and not just if you give a heter, if you say that it's only rabbinic, it can lead to all sorts of problems. This notion that we saw, I want to go back now. The Chasam Sofer says, Tov Halos Asaiser. Here it is at the top. This has been seen by Yaakov Katz, by Moshe Samet, as a crucial element of the Chasam Sofer's approach. They both stress this in discussing the Chasam Sofer's battle with reform, that we raise the level of the Isser. I want to show you, hold on a second. Let's go back to the Chasam Sofer. I want to show you, though, what the Maariv Chayes has to say about this. He says in his note, on Chasam Sofer's point, Tova Halos Esa Isser, he says, in my opinion, Madati, lo nachon, beinai hachata de mutaraos heyesur. He says, in my opinion, it is incorrect to say that you can raise the level of an isur. The lomar al isur lotase greda, to say about a lotase, shehu ba'ase velotase, to tell people that even though it's a lotase and an ase. And then he continues, he says, even though we see that the sages, the Chassam Umar Ischaya says, would exaggerate. We know that the rabbis exaggerate. The Rambam already says that. So, and he brings some example here, right? And we see exaggerations, negative and positive. They say this is the worst in the world. They say if you observe this mitzvah, it's like all 613 mitzvot. He says, that, he quotes the Rambam as saying they did this, they did this to instill upon people how significant it was. So it says, and there's things where they say that you're chayav misa, and it's like you worshipped idolatry. That we know already, that the rabbis would say it's like you worshipped idolatry, or it's like you fulfilled all the mitzvot, or it's like you violated the whole Torah, things like that. But then he says, these are just iyumim lahafchi. These are just ways of, threatening people, instilling on them fear, not to violate it. Avalomara, Isser Durabonon, Shu Isser Torah. But if you're going to tell me that an Isser Durabonon is an Isser Torah, the Rambam says, in Olas Mamrim, that you violated Baal Tosif. If you say to someone that a rabbinic commandment is a Torah commandment, you violated Baal Tosif, which is a Torah commandment you're violating. Kevan Sheino Asur Rakmi Durabonon, Asur Lamar Shalsur Min HaTorah. And then you can't say it's Asur Min HaTorah. Then he says it's also Midvar Shaka Tircha. You're violating the Torah, says to keep far from a false matter, even though you're doing it for a reason. And he ends, the Maratz Chayis ends, the Chazal, Diktaku b'chol eis la'amon al-birur, eis ha'inyan midivari Torah, eis ha'midivari Sofrim, al-mechom dek anaf min al-dina. He says that Chazal were always very careful to determine and to let us know when it's deraisa, when it's derabana, and really it has no significant, no real difference. We have to follow all of them, and yet the rabbis were very careful to let us know. Okay, very strong response to Chassam Sofer, but my response to Maratz Chayis is, you said, Maratz Chayis, that it's usur to say about an isur derabana and that it's an isur Torah. Where does the Chassam Sofer say that? He doesn't say that at all. The Chassam Sofer never says that. He says tovo halos as a isur, and he's talking about a case where there's a where most assume that it's only a negative commandment, and the Ramban says it's a positive and a negative commandment. And then he says that in that case, since at least the Ramban says that it's tovo halos as a isur, but where does? And then he speaks about how you should not rely on rejected views, I guess you would say, that hold that, say, certain things about Shabbos are only Durabanan, because that'll lead people to reject it. And if and certainly don't say publicly that it's only a rabbinic prohibition, even if you think so. But where does the Chassam Sofer say here that Tov Halos Asa Isser means that you take a rabbinic prohibition and you are Halos Asa Isser, you increase that and say, help people, it's Torah prohibition? He doesn't say it anywhere. The Chassam Sofer, the Maratz Chayis is wrong. As far as I can see, he's accusing the Chassam Sofer of saying something which the Chassam Sofer doesn't say. But yes, the Chassam Sofer says to raise the level of an Isser, it's good to do. But that doesn't mean he's saying that we take a rabbinic prohibition, and since people don't listen to the rabbinic prohibition, tell them it's a Torah prohibition. It's true that he continues. The Chassam Sofer, he talks about how the people they don't pay attention to, but he doesn't say therefore tell them it's a Torah prohibition. What he's saying is that the Noda B'Yehuda shouldn't have come out with a heter based on the fact that non-Jewish writing is derabanan, and in general you don't need to tell them about every rabbinic prohibition. It's only a rabbinic prohibition. But that's not the same thing as telling that. That means you're not telling them that it's a rabbinic prohibition. But that's not the same thing as actually telling them it's a Torah prohibition when it's only rabbinic. So I have no doubt here that the Maratz Chayis is mistaken in this matter. Because look, if the Chassam Sofer thought that that was acceptable, he wouldn't, if the Chasam Sofer thought it was acceptable to tell people, and we're going to see that there are Achronim who do think it's acceptable, but not the Chasam Sofer. If the Chasam Sofer thought it was acceptable to say that it's a Torah prohibition when it's only rabbinic prohibition, then he would have said so. Why does he need to cite the Ramban? He's telling you that the only reason I'm saying that it's a Torah, that it's an asay and a lotasay is because, you know, the Ramban says so. But wait a second. If the whole idea, if you're allowed to misrepresent the Torah in order to get people to follow it, then I don't need the Ramban. I can just tell them, I can just say you violate two prohibitions. That to me is obvious. However, even if the Chasam Sofer, and what I'm saying, my interpretation of the Chasam Sofer is, I'm saying it's not, I mean, that I read it and I assume that it's the first time I read it, but subsequently when I was investigating it, that's the standard understanding of the Chasam Sofer. The standard understanding is what I just said. And the assumption is that the Maharal Shlais is incorrect. But even if the Maharal Shlais is incorrect in attributing this to the Chasam Sofer, there were others who held this position. That the Maharal Shlais attributes to the Chasam Sofer, namely that you can take a rabbinic prohibition and you can tell the masses, the Hamonam, that it's a Torah prohibition. Because at the end of the day, why do the Hamonam need to know the truth? There's no nafka mina. If the job of a rabbi is to keep the people observant, if he knows that the people are not going to listen, if they know it's rabbinic and they tell and they ask him, is it rabbinic or not? He can tell them, no, it's a Torah prohibition. Or if he thinks just by announcing it, it's going to help matters. This leads to a fundamental dispute that I wrote about in Changing the Immutable. You can find it on Amazon, those who are interested. My other two books from Littman, Limits of Orthodox Theology and Between Yeshiva and Modern Orthodoxy, for months, for some reason, we couldn't get them on Amazon. They just these third-party sellers. But Baruch Hashem, last week, they're now available on Amazon. And so anyone who wants to buy, feel free. So I speak in Changing the Immutable, this view that you can tell people it's a Torah prohibition when it's only rabbinic in opposition to the Maharal Shlais, and they don't think it's a problem. And this has great contemporary relevance. I mentioned last week because the Frimmer brothers, they wrote a whole long essay in tradition on women's prayer groups. And they dealt with like statements like from the YU Rosh Yeshiva that it's usur. So they have a whole appendix there saying, because many people suspected when they said it's usur, it's not really usur, like you can point to a source, it's usur. It's usur because they feel it's going to lead to bad things, bad results. Much like maybe it's not technically usur to pray in the vernacular, but we know where it's going to lead to. So the Frimmers have a whole appendix there. Can you misrepresent the Torah for positive goals? And they show that this is a huge dispute with big authorities on both sides of the issue. For public policy, can you say that something's forbidden and even forbidden from the Torah if it's not really? They conclude that the consensus of codifiers maintain that public policy considerations doesn't entitle you to misrepresent halakha. But I don't think that's true. I think from the very sources they cite, there's no consensus. I think it's a dispute and it remains a dispute. I mean, just to give you some examples, none other than, forget the Rashba, I mean, he's great enough. But in our own day, Rav Avad Yosef and Chaim Kanievsky both state that it's permissible to misrepresent the reason or the source of a prohibition. And the Frimmers cite sources that do hold you can upgrade, in quotes, a biblical rabbinic prohibition to a biblical one, which is how Maharal Shlais understood the Chasam Sofer. So this is a dispute, and there's plenty of authorities that say to oppose it. And Rav Chaim David Levy, actually, he was chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, he says the whole dispute is irrelevant today, because today, if you lie to your community, it'll get out. People, this is before the internet, he said this. He died before there was an internet. He died, I think, in 98. But he said that if you tell your congregants something, they're going to find out the truth, and then they're going to lose respect for you. So in our day and age, you have to be honest with them. But there is a trend in our tradition. It doesn't mean I like it, but it's there, that permits misrepresentation and even outright falsification of halakha if it serves a good purpose. That is, there's this idea that for the masses, they don't need to know, and the elites, they know the truth. You don't find this in the... Well, you sort of, some passages you might be able to find sources from the Gemara. You definitely find the idea of halacha ve'morin kein. That is, you don't need to let the masses in on all the truths. Rav Shechter quotes in Nefesh Rav or Pnimei Rav that the Rav told his students that even though Kraft cheese was kosher, that's what he held, because it was a vegetable rennet. And he held like the view in Tosfos that we're not concerned that basically Gvinas Akum is like Chol Visrael. It's not a matter, it's not like Shlita, where you need the Jew to be involved. Today we don't hold like that, none of the kashrus organizations. But he said, don't tell the Balabatim this, because they won't know how to distinguish properly. But that's not the same thing as telling them falsehoods, but we have examples. I gave a great example in my book about a rabbi, Eliyahu Russoff, who was confronted with an unbelievable question, where guy was sitting Shiva, and the last day of Shiva is Shabbos, and he wanted to know, do you sit Shiva on Shabbos? And the reason he wanted to know is because he had a store that he wasn't Shomer Shabbos. So he wanted to go back to the store because his wife was running it and she was doing a terrible job. So Rabbi Russoff says, well, if I tell him the truth, that there is no Shiva, then he's going to be Mechal Shabbos. On the other hand, can I lie to him and tell him there is Shiva? Like today, this would not even be a question because anyone could open up Maurice Lamb's book or go on the internet and you know the answer to that. But he decides in the end that I'm not going to tell the truth to this person. We do a simple Jews. And he tells them that it's Shabbos. So there is, you have to stay in the house, but you can put on regular clothes, all that sort of thing, but you're not allowed to leave the house. So he lies to him and he tells him that there's some avelos and that you have to stay in the house on the final day. Because otherwise, the person's going to go to a store. After all, in any event, the Amos ends. You only do a tiny bit the last day. But he says, and he defends himself, and he goes through the whole thing. What's the role of the rabbi? He speaks about a revos, that we're responsible for everyone. You might say, why do I care what this guy does? But no, all Jews are responsible for one another, and there's cosmic significance. So we try our hardest. We don't even want Jews who are Mechal Shabbos. We try to avoid it if we can. Putting him in a situation where they're going to be Mechal Shabbos. So it's a long dispute. You can read about it in my book. Incidentally, in my book, I found that the Meiri says that the Talmud sometimes attributes biblical authority to rabbinic laws. It says that the Talmud says that honoring a step-parent is a Torah law, even though we know it's only a rabbinic command. And the Meiri explains that human psychology being what it is, you can assume that step-parenting in ancient times was as difficult and often as thankless as it is today. So well, the Meiri says that the Talmud, this statement that it's a Torah law, they were raising the prohibition, that is, not to mistreat step-parents, to encourage people to give proper respect. I couldn't find anyone else who says this. And therefore, I'm assuming all the other Rishonim think that this opinion is an outlying opinion, which we don't accept. But the Meiri doesn't see it as an outlying opinion. The Meiri sees it as in line with all the other opinions. But this is an example of where something is being said al derech hafchid, that is no different than when the Gemara sometimes says that if you violate this, it's like you worship idolatry or you violate the whole Torah. So here, too, they exaggerate. To get people to properly behave. Incidentally, also, since I mentioned Rav Shechter in Nefesh HaRav says that he agrees with Ritzvi Yoshchayas. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik says that, and the Rav would hold this also, that to misrepresent halacha, to say that a rabbinic prohibition is biblical, he thinks that this is a violation of the Torah law, Midvar Shachar Tirchak, that the that you can't say a false matter. And this became a problem in Germany. I discussed this in Limits in Between the Yeshiva World. You had the whole problem of stunning before Shlita. And the rabbis declared that you couldn't stun before Shlita. And Rav Chaim Moshe Grzynski said that we can't give reasons. We have to just say it's absolutely forbidden. Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg thought that he could find a way to permit it. that with the new types of stunning, it wouldn't create internal problems. But Rav Chaim Moshe Grzynski prevailed on him to not publish this, and he didn't publish it until the first volume of the Sridi Eish in, 1960. But Rav Chaim Jacob Weinberg writes how people are wondering, is it really prohibited? Or the rabbis, because Shechita, how important it is, are just telling people it's prohibited. And there were plenty of people in Germany, we know, who thought that it really wasn't prohibited halachically. And Rabbi Weinberg himself said that for many of the rabbis, it had nothing to do with halacha. He said the Hasidic rebbes immediately declared stunning forbidden. It has nothing to do with halacha. It's simply because this is the Jewish practice. And so this became a big issue then as well, for meta-halachic reasons, I guess you can call it. Now, why do Rav Chaim Moser said that we can't give reasons? He says, just say it's forbidden. Not because Rav Chaim Moser definitely had halachic reasons. Unlike the other rabbis, the Hasidic rabbis, and not just Hasidic, but mostly Hasidic. Rav Chaim Moser said that if we give reasons as to why, if we say that you can't stun an animal before Shechita because of this and that, then all of a sudden it becomes a matter of halachic discussion. We're giving a reason, and someone else then is going to come back with another reason, taking issue with us, and then it's a machlokes, and if it's a machlokes, the hamonam looks and says, ah, there's different opinions. Okay, I'll go with the lenient opinion. Once it's a dispute, you know that all of a sudden, then it's not an absolute isser, because it can't be an absolute isser, because if there's rabbis disputing it, it's not absolute. So Chaim Moser said, this is one of the things that we need to, we can't give a reason, we just need to say, almost like Das Torah, that it's but unlike Das Torah, it's not coming from the charismatic personality. He has the reason. Chaim Moser knows perfectly well, halachically, why it is, but he says, we can't let the masses have these reasons, because then rabbis, second level rabbis, will start arguing and they'll create a problem. The only other time I know about this, I believe, was Rav Chaim Moser said similarly with electricity on Shabbos. If I'm not mistaken, Rav Chaim Moser said we have to simply say it's usser without explaining why it's usser. If it's not Rav Chaim Moser, it might be Rav Chanan Wasserman. I can't remember. I think it's Rav Chaim Moser, because again, if you start explaining why, then it starts breaking it down. So I'll leave you with this so you can think about. These are interesting questions to think about. Does this encourage practice of halacha if you're not totally honest, or the opposite? I'll say a little more about this next class, and then I think we'll have some more stuff to say about the Chasam Sofer, some interesting things, and then I'm going to show you a reformist text out of Lakewood, believe it or not. Something that I think it'll blow you away when you see this reformist text, and maybe next class we'll even meet the violinist. That's what they would call him. You know who the violinist is? If you don't know who the violinist is, we shall meet. If you that's the German word for violinist. I'll introduce you to that individual, Gaon of learning, unbelievable Gaon. Unfortunately, he went to the dark side, the violinist. Okay, hold on, we have the questions. I was waiting to see. No one says. Anyone? We have some German speakers here. How do you say violinist in Hebrew, in German? I think you say violinisten, but it's also Geiger. Geiger is the violinist. So Geiger is someone who plays the violin. So I remember in one of the Hebrew texts attacking him, they called him the Menagain. And I keep calling the Menagain. I mean, who's the Menagain? Who's the attacking? And finally, I figured it out that it's Geiger. So we'll probably meet Abraham Geiger. And he is. His learning is really beyond belief, how much he knew, but he used it for the wrong purposes. Okay, Ellen says, yes, the truth is that for the hey interrogative, it has to be a hey with a patach. However, if you look at the verse, it appears, here, I'll show you the verse again. It appears, hold on a second, let me find it here. Pull it up here. It does appear that something's missing. It says Leros Hafarcha Hagefen. Then Hinei Tzu Harimonim. Where's the hey interrogative? You'd expect a hey interrogative there. That's why it's been suggested that an initial hey has dropped off. I saw that in one of the sources. And others have said that no, that this is just that's just the form, not a problem. So let's see.
Rabbi Mark, I take back what I, looking at that verse, it's from Shir HaShirim.
Yeah.
Once you start talking about poetry, you really can't, you can't derive dictic rules from poetry, because he's, he can use it for the meter. He didn't want that extra in there.
But so everyone's agreeing that it's, that's part of the root. Well, I shouldn't say that. Not everyone agrees. It's either a he feel, or it's Ben Yehuda has it, as I said, as part of the root.
Right. Evan Shoshan says it's the he feel.
Yeah.
Nun tzadi tzadi is the, was the word.
Yes, and, indeed. That's what he does. But Rabbi Mazuz's guy says it's the root is, he agrees with Ben Yehuda. But however you look at it, we're back to the answer that, as Mel said, that it's Hanet Sachama. And really, it's the Gemara, that's what the Gemara calls it. So the only question is we have to figure out why the Gemara refers to it as Hanet Sachama, not Netzachama. But we know that it's correct because the Gemara refers it. Now, why it's the other way has come in, well, I guess we can start trying to correct people. Hyman says in several circles is pronounced Hennitz. Well, as I said, hold on, I have it here. The that's what, do I have my paper here? That is exactly, yes, Hennitz. That's a segol and a seire. That's how it's vocalized in Ben Yehuda's dictionary. Ben Yehuda gives you lots of sources of the use of it. No, Susanna, it shouldn't be hanetz. It should be, well, I shouldn't say that. I think Ibn Shushan does have hanetz. But if it's hanetz, then it should be a... well, if it's not, if it's, it should be, it should be a chataf patach under the hay, because we're not assuming that it's the hay.
Well, as if it's a hay, the chataf patach would be for if it's a hay ashela. But I'm thinking it's like, you know, the rising or the shining of the sun.
No, but that would, but then you'd be correct. But then you wouldn't say that. You would say netzachama. You wouldn't say hanetzachama. You, what you're saying is a verb. No, you wouldn't say. You say netzachama. Hanetz. No, it would be netzachama because it would be a construct.
The hay from the hefil.
Oh well, no, but then it's not a patach then.
No, it would be a kamat.
That's I think I believe that's what Ibn Shushan has. Hold on, I think I made a note of this.
Ibn Shushan has
a tsere, hey nates. No, the Ibn Shushan I have has as a comments, like Susanna says, ha nates.
My Ibn Shushan has hey nates in hifil.
Yeah, and but Ben Yehuda has hey nates. Yeah, I'm not reading from the literary Ben Shushan. I'm reading from Atar Hasafa HaIvrit. When I Googled it, it came up. So there's a whole discussion there. But he says that the nikud should have been a chataf patach, not a kamatz. That is, hanetzachama should have been a chataf patach for Ibn Shushan. But Rabbi Kelman says, Rabbi Eider first went to YU before Lakewood. That is correct, indeed. It's fascinating how you never see the books anymore. They were once very popular. I first started using them when I had the Pesach, Shabbos. I think the reason is because we've gotten better books and more detailed books. That's all. But they're still very good. I didn't know, Mike, that Rabbi Eider was the Rav for the Upen Eruv as well. In those days, I don't know how many people traveled around to do Eruvin. I guess he was one of them. By the way, speaking of traveling around, Rabbi Nutter Greenblatt of Memphis passed away 2 days ago, or 2 days. The funeral was yesterday, or I think it was yesterday. I watched it online. He would travel all over the whole week for Gittin issues. If you're any of you from Memphis, you certainly know Rav Nutter. He was the uncle of Rav Ephraim Greenblatt, although they're basically the same age. Remember, my class on my latest book, you learned a lot about Rabbi Ephraim Greenblatt, but I never met Rav Natan Greenblatt, unfortunately. And we also learned that in the 50s, Rabbi Shimon Eider was the head lifeguard at Camp Korina. Okay, yeah. And in charge of learning at Camp Monk. Hyman says, how about four cups of Sulevitz? Or that's the kind of fashos. They say you can't. Remember, the Gemara says that even if it hurts your head, you're supposed to drink it. But if you physically, for you're allergic or whatever, and a nazir is, he can't break his naziris. And Rabbi says that he uses his alachot for the footnotes. He quotes from Moshe with three. That is correct. Shimon Eider's book was significant because he went to Rav Moshe and he had oral psakim from Rav Moshe before this became popular in an English book to have oral psakim of Rav Moshe. And it says you used him as your posek. When I first became a rabbi, I always spoke about his years at BTA and YU. I'm glad to see that they always spoke about his years because some of these people, they cover it up. They don't want anyone to know about it. It's like, I know a rabbi who remained nameless. He's a Baal Tshuva, you know, went to Lakewood, the whole bit. He makes believe, he made believe once that he didn't know who the Yankees were. He grew up irreligious and and that's not right because it doesn't take away from it. That's who you are. That's where you came from. He asked, who are the Yankees? Who are they? I mean, even the Satmar Chassid didn't know who the New York Yankees are.
By the way, it's 2-2 in the ninth inning, Yankees and Blue Jays. Yankees are in Toronto for a three-game series. I just went to look. It's 2-2 in the top of the ninth. Okay.
Well, I don't follow.
Who the Yankees are and the Blue Jays. Okay.
Rachmiel mentions, and this is in the Evil article, he mentioned married into the Medford Weiss family, the single wealthiest Jewish family in Hungary. Their wealth was expropriated by the Nazis. If you read the Evil Encyclopedia, you can see all that. Yes. Alan, the rare Bible, you shall commit adultery. There's a name for that Bible. I forget what it's called. It's a, what that's always, we have different versions.
Look at the next note. It tells you the name.
Paul says the name, the Wicked Bible. Only 20 copies exist. This is important because we assume sometimes every time you see an alternate reading that it has significance. It could just be a mistake. And often they give the example of that. Someone points out privately, most women in Europe could not read. So there are women who could, and they would lead the women in the davening. Correct. I mentioned that. The significant point, however, is that we have references to the base Knesset of the Nushim. That, if you recall, during the whole dispute over women's prayer groups, one of the arguments was that if the women are not davening in the shul, they lose tefillah b'tzibur, and they're not with the minyan. That didn't seem to be an issue years ago when they assumed that the women, there's no minyan of tefillah b'tzibur for women. So if the women want to, there's no criticism in any of the earlier literature that the women getting together to do that. And for example, my daughter was at seminary for 2 years. They had like women's tefillah, let's say you would have sometimes. They never made it. And I don't know of any seminaries where they make a big deal that you have to go to daven with a minyan. The girls daven together with the girls. They don't make it that you have to go to a minyan all the time to feel a bit seabor. But during the dispute over the women's prayer groups, all of a sudden we see they're talking about the fact that the women are missing to feel a bit seabor. When I have to tell you, until the 1980s, I've never seen any source that talks about how it's important for women to get to feel a bit seabor. So if you want to be a historian, like Jacob Katz's model, you would argue, just like he was arguing about we saw with the Hamburg, the rabbis in Elo Divrei Abis, you'd say, well, you know, could it be that the reason now the rabbis are stressing the women need to fill up at Seabor, and we never heard of this before that, is precisely because just like they used to fight against the reformers, now they're fighting against these more liberal Orthodox. And in order to put a stop to this, which they believe is inappropriate, therefore, they start stressing something that never before in history, to my knowledge, had anyone ever mentioned that there's an inyan of a woman coming to tefillah b'tzibur. I already told you that in Gerba, other than hearing Megillas Esther, There's no such concept of the women going to shul, and even going, they don't even go to the shul. They sit outside the shul when you read it for them. So I don't know. As a historian, I'd be very curious to probe this further. Why all of a sudden is there an inyan for women for tefillah b'tzibur? And it's definitely not a coincidence that it's in response to the women's prayer groups, which could be criticized for all sorts of good reasons. But are these halachic arguments, or are these sort of metahalachic arguments? We see, thank you, Mike, that the PhD of Rebbetzin, because she's a Rebbetzin and she runs a girls' school, her PhD dissertation, you can see it online. There you go. Rabbi Kelman says it's scary to think a Gedolei Torah may not be telling the truth. It's an issue with the Magen Avraham. Magen Avraham actually cites this halacha that you can alter the truth. And it makes sense. You can see the argument. If I can alter the truth so that someone's not offended, why can't I alter the truth so that someone properly serves Hashem? You can make that argument. Those who've seen my book know the back and forth. Someone asked, what's the spelling and meaning of Sfir Shchayas' name? The name is Chet Yud Vav Saf. Is it Chayas' son, like Isaac, or Chayot? In Hebrew, they call it Chayot. It's Chayas. We have the name before him as well. I don't know. Maybe it's from Chaya. We know maybe named after a woman. I have to look. I can't remember what Hutna David or Hershkovitz says about the name. We have examples. For example, the Marsha, Adels. That's after his mother, his grandmother, his mother. And we have a number of examples like that. So maybe. Yes, thank you, Hyman. Yeah, that's what we said. So then why, if Hyman says correctly, that's a Torah prohibition to say that Durabanan is Daraisa, what is the Chasam Sofer? How could the people like Rav Vad Yosef say otherwise? Because here you're doing it not to misrepresent the Torah. Here you're doing it to keep people in the fold. I guess that's the argument they could. They don't see this as Ziyaf HaTorah. They see this as the masses. The masses are not entitled to all the information because they're the masses. You can't lie to a Talmud Chacham. You can't lie in a shir. But when you're trying to keep the masses on the straight and narrow, you can.
Sounds a little bit like the Catholic Church, that they were trying to keep people ignorant.
They were. In fact, they refused to allow translations of even the Kiddush Shulchan Aruch. What Rabbi Yellen cites there from Rabbi Dessler, I cite that in my book as well, that truth is truth. What's truth is what keeps you in line with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's truth. That's a higher truth. So there you go. Let me go quickly. There are alternate truths. That's exactly. There's truth and there's truth. The truth, the capital T, truth and the small t. I don't know which is with, but the ultimate truth is to be in line with God and to follow halacha. The other truth is a lesser truth that can be dispensed with for certain people, just like our children. Do we always tell our children the truth? No. We want them to do the right thing. Please take a look at my book. You'll see all the different sources. There's Gemaras that speak about this. I think this is a dispute that goes back to the days of the Gemara, and it goes through the Rishonim. We're uncomfortable with it today because we believe in that all the facts should be out there and that we don't believe in covering things up. But there's a whole tradition of this. Mike says, just as a tradition to overemphasize some prohibitions, isn't the converse also true? Not to tell women about some prohibitions? We're pretty sure they won't keep. It's not just women. The Gemara says this. K'shem shemitzvah lomar, just like it's a mitzvah to say that's what they will listen to, kach mitzvah, it's a mitzvah not to say what they won't listen to. A rabbi who knows his community is not going to follow something is not supposed to get up and tell them that. We discussed this in the first, when I dealt with my latest book. When you're learning in Shulchan Aruch, you're not supposed to skip, but you're not supposed to tell people something. If you're not in the most observant community and everyone came and they brought their baby carriages, and then you get a note you get a message that the Erev is down. The psak as given by big rabbis is you're not supposed to get up and you're not supposed to announce the Erev's down because the people are still going to push the carriages and now they're doing it b'mezid. they say you're not supposed to make a public announcement. You tell a few people who you know are pious and listen to. Every rabbi knows this, and this is not a modern thing. This goes back to the Gemara. Better that they're shoging than they're mazing. Do not tell people about things if you know they're not going to listen. So that's Talmudic. Harvey says it appears that rabbis are treating us like children. No, not us. We're here learning on Monday night. We're part of the elites. We get all the information. But there's a distinction between the Hamon Am. The rabbis distinguish between the Hamon Am. All everyone agrees the rabbis distinguish between Hamon Am and the elites. Some achronim hold that you can even distort things for the Hamon Am, but everyone knows. The Gemara already says that the Hamon Am doesn't get all the information. There's a halacha of Ein Morin Kein. We have certain halachot that we can't tell the Hamon Am because they can't handle it. Like the movie says, they can't handle the truth. And every rabbi knows this also. When you get up and give a sermon, there's certain things you say. And certain things you don't say. If you have a small shiur, your five best talmidim, you'll speak about more complicated matters because that's self-selected. People come, but when you're giving a sermon and everyone's sitting there, you don't raise all sorts of problematic issues. Some people will be troubling for them. They won't grasp it. That's the Rambam explicitly distinguishes between those who are able to be let into certain truths and everyone else who's not. And this is based on the Gemara. We're not allowed to teach Maisa Merkava to a group. Why not? Just individuals. Because not everyone is able, not everyone is deserving of the truths. I know this sounds very elitist, but that's our tradition, that there are certain things that not everyone is. Okay, about the Chaim Moser and electricity. We've gone along far. Yes, so Ferdinand, Shopik, okay, someone from my town. So the violinist works as well as Geiger. But I think in the 19th century that they didn't use violinist. I think they used Geiger because that's the references that I seem to be that I found to Geiger. I could be wrong on that, but you're a native German speaker, not me. And thank you for this quickly. Chaim says he doesn't believe Rav Chaim Moser is the one who refused to give a reason for the issue of electricity. He was known for using a light bulb for Avdola to emphasize it was actually Aish. Yeah, you're right. He did say that, Avdola. So I'm not sure. There's definitely one. I'll find it for next week. And finally, the name is not Evan Shushan, it's Evan Shoshan. Correct. That's right. We can go on. I'll end with Mel because we began with Mel. The point about tefillah b'tzibur is not that it is required, is that tefillah b'tzibur is more valuable than participation by women in the service. Are you saying, Mel, that tefillah b'tzibur is more valuable to women than women by themselves? Because I never saw anyone ever mention this in any of the Gemara, in the Rishonim, or anywhere that there's an idea that a woman should go to shul because there's a kiyum of tefillah b'tzibur. I'm not saying not true.
But if they want to do something better, then that's what they should do. Rather than
But who says it's better? No, but who says it's better? Maybe it's better for a woman, let's say, who feels she gets kavana and feels that's necessary. But let's say you have a woman who feels maybe otherwise. In other words, there's no chiyuv. So, but if you recall, during the women's prayer groups, this was brought in to say why the women shouldn't do this. And I remember at the time, I was a youngster at that time, I remember thinking, well, then how come all the girls' schools, they do davening, they don't bring them every morning to daven with the, you know, in the local shul, they do their little davening in the base alcove. So they obviously don't think that there's really such an important inyan. They don't want women's prayer groups. Women's prayer groups are dangerous. They could lead to feelings of egalitarianism. They could lead to a breakdown of tradition, all sorts of reasons, which I get. And I understand why. I just am pointing to the fact that that was one of, I think it might have been Rav Schechter who mentioned this, the whole about tefillah b'tzibur. I just found it unusual that that's the stress. As I said, in Gerba, they all daven, but they don't feel that it's important to go to the shul. The women can get together and do their davening. But it's not women's prayer group there, because a women's prayer group was a feminist innovation with consciously feminist. When the women in Gerba And God willing, I'm going to Gerba the day after Shavuos, but I'll give you something else. Five students, because of me, five Princeton students are going to Gerba in 2 weeks for the Lag BaOmer celebration. My daughter and four others, if you can believe it, and Princeton University is funding it. So that should be a lot of fun. But the point is that the women there, they're just doing it because that's their tradition. So I get it. I understand perfectly well. But the issue is when Rav Shechter writes, there were two oppositions to it. You had first the statement that came out from the five Rosh Yeshiva. That was like a more of a Das Torah, a basic statement explaining this is forbidden. Rav Shechter felt like he had to give a halachic argument. And he writes a long essay, Tzilch Bechfeat Son. And there he tries to argue halachically. And the problem, and I think this is where Chaim Ozer was speaking about with the Shlita, once you start arguing halachically, then you can challenge it. And if you recall back 3 decades ago, people then started challenging. And then you say, well, Rav Shechter says this, but this is, it's weak here. Then all of a sudden, since it's, you, maybe not all of his arguments are so slam dunk, then it's a machokas. You have, let's say, Rabbi Avi Weiss here and you have Rav Shechter. Now it's a machokas. And then you could say, if this is the best Rav Shechter can come up with, then maybe there is room for leniency. That's why Rav Chaim Ozer, I think, would have said, if he was around, we don't give reasons why the women's prayer group is not correct. We understand that it's not correct, not for halachic reasons necessarily. That's why the Rav, by the way, didn't sign the letter, because the Rav opposed it, but the Rav said it's not a halachic argument, and he didn't want to sign the letter of the Rosh Yeshiva that said it's usur. The Rav was opposed to it. Because you can be opposed to something, you think that something is going to lead to all sorts of bad results without actually being able to point to a siman in the Shulchan Aruch. We're not halachocentric in the way that Abraham Adonijah Heschel attacked the Orthodox. There's plenty of things we do because it's the Masorah, it's the tradition, etc. That's how I see it. I know I'm more conservative with a small C on this than many of the listeners, but what can you do? We all have freedom of speech, freedom of thought. So sometimes I'm more conservative. Okay, we'll end here. Thank you very much for a very insightful questions, your nice debate going on here, a lot of fun. Rabbi.
That's why, by the way, when I read the OU reason why you can't have women rabbis, I became much more in favor of women rabbis. If that paper was the best that they could do, that none of us can articulate a reason why it's us, but we all know it's us, sir. That didn't do it for me. So I'm not here to discuss, but that's exactly what you say. By the way, the reason I would think that you would say a woman should daven with a minyan, which is something I've always encouraged, by the way, women, not necessarily instead of women's prayer group, whatever, but because we believe tefillot are nishma'ot, better. When you daven with a minyan, HaKadosh Baruch Hu hears you. Take Rav Soloveitchik, explain the Yachid Litzibur. There's a totally different understanding of our relationship to God when I daven as an individual and when I daven as part of a community. And God made a covenant with the community. Our tefillot are heard much more. So I think that's the reason I or anybody would encourage women daven with tefillot, not to hear Baruch Hu and say Yesh Me Rabbah. That's minor. It's the idea of davening with the minyan that's important.
I would agree that today.
Again, I'm not getting the argument.
I would agree with you. Today the shul serves that function for men and women. But for hundreds of years,
women didn't go to shul, everything, right? Women didn't, the Magen Avraham says, the woman says the Modani, and that's how they
today, if women don't go to shul Shabbos morning, they're at home, what do they read? Reading the newspaper. So they, right. Definitely you're losing, you know. But Gerba is a different place.
But it is, I think all of us find it disconcerting about the idea that, a great Torah scholar may not be telling the truth for us in the modern Orthodox community. That's very troubling because it calls into question so much of what we hear when they make pronouncements. But yes, I agree. Being in Rav Shechter's shir and everything, these reaper were totally MF. And Rav Shechter very often stressed the idea that saying a din derabanan is a deraita, and these are baltosif who quote the Rambam all the time. And I heard that from him many, many times. And that's the Brisker tradition, to be totally honest. But as you say, it's not everybody's tradition. Nunu, like you say, lots of food for thought. And not everything that has happened in our tradition makes us comfortable. And I'm honest enough to admit it. You know, what can we do? Anyways, all right. Thank you very much, everybody. Tomorrow we'll learn about the Dome of Torah in early Judaism. Malkus Simcha, we're going to go back 2,000 years to how Torah developed. That's at 2 p.m. Eastern time, 1 p.m. Central time in Chicago, where she's based. And then tomorrow night, like I said at the beginning, 8:30, Michelle Chesner, the librarian at Columbia University, will be speaking on about books and Jewish history, the development of the book. I think I was very fascinated when I was first heard about her. So that's tomorrow night at 8:30. And we look forward to seeing you all during the week. And as always, please invite a friend. And watch out for the emails. I think I sent them in earlier with all the weekly programs. And we look forward to learning with you. And Laila Tov, everybody. And thank you very much. Always interested to hear comments. And nobody has to agree with anything I say. I don't even always agree with everything I say. So, sometimes I change my mind. I'm not sure. But whatever. Okay. Laila Tov, everybody. Thank you very much.
Laila
Tov. Bakasha.
Thank Bye-bye. You. Good night.
Thank you. Thank you. I have to go check the score in the Yankee game. I didn't check recently. Okay. Before you say the Yankees. All right. All right. Good
down
night.
Down 1-1.
I'm sorry?
Jays are down 1-1.
Oh, Jays are down 1-1. There you go. Okay. All right. What can you do? But I think the Leafs are winning, though.
Yeah, big time.
The Leafs are winning. Okay. Hockey, but no, Toronto winning 4 games, that's nearly an impossibility. All right. Lights up, everybody.